This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Eastern North Carolina is the home of many Civil War battlefields, and more recently, submarine warfare off the state's coast during World War II that could be viewed by Barrier Island residents. But fighting on Eastern North Carolina soil occurred long before those wars. A Wilmington author has written a book about war in the East decades before the American Revolution. George Olson has more.
War might not always be inevitable, but according to David Levere, the Tuscarora War that started in 1711 was pretty close to an accomplished fact.
Every colony went through one of these big wars between the Indians, and this was North Carolina's turn.
David Levere is the author of The Tuscarora War, Indians, Settlers, and the Fight for the Carolina Colonies. The first official blow in the war was struck by Indians in September 1711 when they attacked European settlers on the Neuse and Pamlico Rivers, killing at least 140. The match was likely struck weeks before.
When New Bern is created by Baron de Graffenried, and he brings about 300 or so German and Swiss settlers and plops them down, that's Tuscarora territory. And so Tuscaroras and their allies are getting crowded out. And so all these things together finally just, they snapped. And I guess the spark is that when Surveyor General John Lawson and Baron Christopher de Graffenried go up the Neuse River scouting for future lands for their settlement, that the Indians see this as a provocation. And they're captured, put on trial. It's about a three-day trial, and finally John Lawson is executed. You know, once you execute a colonial official, I guess you might as well go all the way, and it's right after that the war starts.
With that and the subsequent attacks on settlers, it at first glance put blame for the start of the Tuscarora War firmly on Indians. But Levere says as there were no innocent Indians, there weren't innocent settlers caught unaware of problems with their native neighbors.
But there were a lot of abuses by settlers. Indians, if they were caught hunting out in the settled areas, risk being murdered or at least being beaten, having their guns taken from them, having their game taken from them. Merchants and traders would go out and abuse Indians in their town. They would rape Indian women. They would beat up Indians. They would get them drunk and take their hides from them. And Indians complained about this.
The Indians also came up with unique solutions to try to ameliorate problems the European presence imposed on them.
John Lawson, in his 1701 trip across the Piedmont, talks about this. And he talks about where you go to these villages, that they would be met by these young women, good-looking young women, called the trading girls. And these were women whose essentially job it was to take these European men who came in and essentially symbolically marry them for the time there. And they would provide the services that a wife would provide, you know, cook for them, but also have sex with them. And in return, these Europeans would provide their families with goods, trade goods, and things like that. But the trading girls was a very recent phenomenon, and the Indians brought it about as an adaptation to these Europeans, because as these Europeans, their idea is that Indian women are really just hypersexual, nymphomaniacs, and are free for anything. And so you start having respectable wives and respectable daughters being raped by these Europeans who just think that all women are lusty. And if you beat up these Europeans or kill one, that could bring dangerous repercussions from South Carolina or North Carolina. So they created trading girls to siphon off, to redirect this European lust. And so it's Indians are having to deal with things like that, where this Europeans come in and we can do whatever we want to do.
But the biggest grievance North Carolina Indians had was the Indian slave trade. For decades, South Carolina had seized Indians, friend and foe alike, to work in sugar colonies on Barbados. But enslaving friendly Indians caused obvious problems, so Levere says South Carolina had wars with enemies to fuel their slave trade, wars which could bleed into their northern neighbor.
African and African-American slavery was only really getting started, and the first slaves were Indians in South Carolina. Took Indian slavery to new heights. They would arm their allies, these Siouan speakers like the Catawbas and the Wateries and the Santees, and send them out across the American South to take slaves. And from about 1675 to about 1715, it was a horrible time to be an Indian in the American South. Because who knows, when suddenly attack a peaceful village and kill the men and take the women and children captive and march them back to Charleston and then send them off to Barbados or keep them in South Carolina or even sell them up into New York and Pennsylvania and North Carolina. And so the Tuscarores complained about this. And why, if we're allies of English North Carolina, why are the allies of English South Carolina attacking us? Why don't you do something about that?
The European presence had changed the view of captives amongst the Native Americans. When wars had been fought before, few captives were taken, and they were often essentially adopted into new tribes. Now, with the Europeans having goods the Indians wanted, captives were a trade ship. So with the changes in their lives and the enslavement of their people, war indeed may have been inevitable, and like the other wars fought between other Indians and other colonies, the colonists would ultimately win. But for North Carolina to win, it required outside help.
North Carolina was probably the poorest colony of there was only 12 colonies then. It had, at that time, no deep water port, so which really hindered commerce. Also, it was heavily divided. It was not a united colony. And by what I mean by that is that there were in the colony Quakers who refused to take oaths, who didn't want to pay taxes to support the Anglican Church. You also have these kind of contrary settlers that had kind of come out of Virginia. They don't want any kind of authority. They don't want to pay taxes. They just want to be left alone. And then you have this other group of these proprietary men, these men who are part of the British Empire, who do want North Carolina to be seated in that empire.
Because of this divide, the North Carolina governor requested assistance from South Carolina. Most battles were a stalemate, but finally in March 1713, Colonel James Moore led an expedition against Indians in Niharoka, which led to a crushing defeat for the Tuscaroras, killing about 370 and enslaving nearly 400. Skirmishes continued until 1715, but for the most part the events in Niharoka near present-day Snow Hill brought the war to a close. For South Carolina, it brought an immediate financial windfall for its slave trade. For North Carolina, it brought a halt to the war and ultimately allowed a westward expansion.
Up to this time, the Tuscaroras were the strongest, most militant Indians in eastern North Carolina, and they more or less acted as a court, preventing settlement out to the Piedmont, but also preventing settlement down into the Cape Fear. And then after this war, after they're broken, the Indian power is broken. Now you quickly have settlement to the Piedmont, settlement to the Cape Fear. And really this, if you want to call it the frontier, or this line of settlement quickly moves out, where then they start dealing with Catawbas, and not long after they'll start dealing with the Cherokees. But this was the big war, the big colonial Indian war for North Carolina, and you know, eventually the colonists always won, and it just really broke the back of Indian power in the East.
David Levere is a professor of history at UNC Wilmington and the author of The Tuscarora War, Indians, Settlers, and the Fight for the Carolina Colonies, published by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm George Olson.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Well, for my family this week, it's Christmas. Your family might be celebrating another holiday, or maybe one at a slightly different time of year. Christmas, of course, involves gift-giving, but as I get older, I find there's almost nothing out there that I feel I would like to be given, and very few things that I think I would like to give others. Maybe a really useful knife for the kitchen. But other than that, there's just not many things any of us need. However, I thought, what if I were to look out in the garden and give only things that I could find in my yard? Now, if you happen to be a family member of mine, don't panic. I'm really not going to give you these things. I simply thought it would be fun to think about it, because the garden is full of gifts for us year-round. The first thing I noticed looking out in my yard, I could give a couple wheelbarrows full of fresh pine needles. Everyone can use pine needles in their yard for some wonderful bed or under a perfect tree. An excellent first gift choice from the backyard. What else? Well, this year I could pull up bouquets of beautiful carrots. They're still out there and they are absolutely gorgeous and way more than I can possibly eat. Now, it might take a little bit longer because they've slowed down so much for the winter, but if I slowly collected them over a week or so, I could give someone a dozen eggs. Oh, and here's a great one. If I go under the house to the worm bin, I haven't cleaned it out for a while, so I could give someone a gallon, maybe two, of worm juice to use as fertilizer. Or, even better, worm castings to mix in with their soil. Also under the house, there's still a few herbs left. Really, just parsley right now and rosemary. But they're wonderful, and I could share them. But the most beautiful gift I could give out of my garden this year would be a basket of citrus. I have tangerines and orange quats, and they are perfect and sweet and bitter and wonderful right now, depending on what part of each one you're eating. Finally, I could cut wonderful boughs of fresh-smelling cedar for someone to turn into a wreath. I don't have the skill. Or, if you're more like me, to stick in a vase for wonderful winter greenery inside. I'm actually kind of amazed, now that I've thought of it, of all the things that I could pull together from my yard and give to people that I cared about as a gift. Maybe I'll take back what I said earlier. If you're in my family, don't be surprised if one of these things shows up under your tree this year. I hope you have a wonderful holiday season with your family, no matter what holiday you practice. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry, next year, in the Garden Journal.
It's the holiday season, a time when thoughts run to tidings of comfort and joy, especially comfort in the form of food. Food played a central part in some classic literature, as it plays a part in family traditions, as commentator Joan Karas explains.
In the musical version of Charles Dickens's novel, Oliver Twist, Oliver and his fellow orphans sing about the joys of food. Food, glorious food, I'm dying to try some. Lovely voices, but the kids look and sound hungry. Certainly the thin gray gruel in their bowls has nothing glorious about it. Those fictional children weren't one bit fictional in Dickens's mind, as he had often been hungry as a child. His father, hopeless at managing money, was put in debtor's prison with his entire family when Charles was only 12. Charles walked a very long way to work in a blacking factory to earn money for them all. A miserable time that lived forever in his mind and later in his written work. A Christmas Carol, which he wrote in 1843, features Ebenezer Scrooge, a confirmed miser who eventually sees the error of his ways. In a flurry of generosity, he calls first for the big prize turkey hanging in the poulterer's window as a Christmas gift for the family of his poor, overworked employee, Bob Cratchit. Scrooge and Dickens focused on food first. As you know, the early pilgrims in America celebrated by eating turkey with the Native Americans at the first Thanksgiving. My own family has eaten turkeys for Thanksgiving and Christmas as long as I can remember. Clearly, the holiday season is a bad time to be a turkey. If you're born a turkey, it would be wise to stay small and stringy-looking so that no one picks you. Those early American turkeys were wild and wily critters, hard to find and shoot, so they most likely were somewhat tough and stringy. Over time, holidays have come to mean food, and lots of it, not just turkeys. The groaning board is not only a phrase, but also a reality. Families that are normally innovative turn into passionate traditionalists in November and December. Turkeys, hams, ducks, and other roast beasts are lovingly selected, prepared, and served, exactly like last year and every other year. However, modern education has turned some of the traditionalists into critics. Your Aunt Susie won't eat turkey anymore because the tryptophan makes her tired and grumpy. Beef is too hard to digest, she says. And how can you eat pork when you know that the pig is the smartest of all domesticated animals? Her husband, Uncle Herman, is local chairman of PETA now and wouldn't go near a murdered duck on a plate. Those are his words. Major food historian Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, an outstanding book, has this mantra: eat food, not too much, mainly plants. Man, oh man, they're coming at us from all sides, aren't they? But Christmas is close now, and I'm not listening. I love turkey and stuffing and gravy, cranberries and mashed potatoes. Hey, potatoes are plants. And the pecans in my pecan pie came from the Powell's trees in Gloucester, North Carolina. The corn in cornbread stuffing was a plant. Cranberries are fruits from a plant. So, we can work around this. All ye who love traditional food, glorious food, stand your ground.
Joan Karas is a children's book author who lives in Beaufort. Her latest book is Magic at the Bed and Biscuit, published by Candlewick Press.
As 2013 draws to a close, we bring you the most listened to story, according to page views from our website, publicradioeast.org.
The treacherous waters along the coast of North Carolina are known around the world as the graveyard of the Atlantic. Thousands of ships have run aground on the shifting shoals, from 16th century exploration vessels to German U-boats that sank during World War II. One of the most famous wrecks is that of the infamous pirate Blackbeard. His flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, sank in 1718 near Beaufort Inlet. Since its discovery in 1996, artifacts from the site have been recovered and preserved. Divers with the North Carolina Department of Cultural Resources Underwater Archaeology Division brought up a pair of 300-year-old cannons from the site about a mile off Fort Macon. It's a clear, sunny day by the docks at the boathouse at Front Street Village in Beaufort as the crew of the Crystal Coast Lady prepare for our trip to the wreck site. We won't actually be involved in the recovery, but we'd be watching from a safe distance. An attempt to raise the cannons was made June 12th, but was called off due to low water visibility and unfavorable weather conditions. But today's forecast looks promising. After a briefing on the history of Blackbeard, approximately 80 people, including Department of Cultural Resources staff, Queen Anne's Revenge experts, members of the Friends of Queen Anne's Revenge, and guests, started boarding the waiting vessel.
Good morning, welcome aboard. We ask everyone to please be cautious as you move around the vessel, especially when going through the lower and upper deck.
We made our way down Taylor's Creek along the Beaufort waterfront, past Radio Island, before making a left and heading through Beaufort Inlet. Along the way, retired underwater archaeologist and our guide for today's trip, Mark Wild Ramsing, points out a dredging platform just a couple hundred yards off the port side.
Here they are dredging as hard as they can, continuing to dredge and keep this channel open. So back in the old days, you didn't have any of that marked channel, no buoys, no nothing. We are heading out the inlet. We'll go straight out a ways. Ahead of us is the Dan Moore. You'll sort of see it about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock on the vessel's starboard side here.
The Dan Moore is assisting in the cannon recovery. The 85-foot ocean-going research vessel belongs to Cape Fear Community College. It's almost 50 years old and has made over 400 research trips.
Okay, everybody, we are now getting close to the site. You can see the recovery vessel, the Dan Moore. It's the big trawler. This is its last voyage before it's going to be mothballed, and this will be actually the biggest, most ambitious lift, trying to raise 3 cannons.
Since the site of the Queen Anne's Revenge is only about a mile off the coast, the shoreline can easily be seen. As we move into position parallel to the vessel Dan Moore, the American flag flying above Fort Macon is just barely visible off our bow. Directly above the wreck site, another smaller barge-like vessel named Jones Bay is anchored.
The Jones Bay came out. They got up at 4 in the morning. They came out at the first sign of light and started excavating. The problem with the way the weather's been, every time they get it ready to go, if another good storm from the southwest comes along, it covers up what they've done. So they had to excavate these cannons. They're already strapped up. They'll be strapped up with big canvas straps or ropes, and you'll see that. Jones Bay, this is Crystal Coast Lady, over.
This is Jones Bay, go ahead.
How's it going over there?
They're about to lift the cannon. They're inflating the bag now.
All right.
To bring the cannon to the surface, divers attach a lift bag to the canvas strap secured around the cannon. The water is only about 25 feet deep at the wreck site, so it doesn't take long for the cannon to float to the surface.
Momentarily, you should see a yellow lift bag come up, or these much bigger than the little buoys you see there, come up right behind the vessel, the Jones Bay, the smaller vessel.
About 5 minutes pass, and then the yellow lift bag breaks the surface of the water.
All right, there it is. So we passed the first stage. Now the second is to get the bag and the divers over to the Dan Moore.
Dan, well, go ahead and haul in the cannon. Haul in the lift bag. Over. Haul it in.
On the deck of the Dan Moore, a team of students with Cape Fear Community College's Marine Technology Program began tugging at a red rope connected to the cannon and the divers about 150 feet away. Onlookers watched nervously as the divers are tossed around by the wind and waves. Then, a troubling message comes over the radio.
Dan Moore, it looks like they're wrapped around that mooring. Over.
I don't know if you heard that, but what's happened now is that the cannon is hooked around one of the mooring lines, so as the Dan Moore tries to pull it, it's not pulling. So now the divers have gone back down to try to release that.
Another tense 5 minutes pass, and finally the red rope is free from the mooring line. The lift bag, cannon, and divers continue to be hauled in until they're floating beside the Dan Moore. This is where the third phase of the lifting process begins. The expert divers with the Department of Cultural Resources Underwater Archaeology Division work quickly to connect the vessel's crane hook to the canvas strap around the cannon. Then the signal is given to lift the cannon from the water.
All right, so now they're hooked to the cannon. The ladder bags have been moved off a little bit, and we should see Blackbeard's big 6-pounder cannon coming up. They weigh about 2,500 pounds, over a ton of metal and some concretion.
We watch and wait several more minutes as the crane reels it in, and for the first time in almost 300 years, the cannon breaks the surface of the water.
There it is. I'd love to see it come out of the water, but I don't cheer until it gets down on the deck.
Even though the 3-century-old artifact is covered in concretion, it's very easy to tell that it's a cannon. As it's slowly lifted out of the water, the crew aboard the Dan Moore lean over the side of the boat to stabilize the cannon and keep it from swaying. Other crew members set up a cinder block and 2x4 platform for the cannon to rest on. Then it's gently lowered as onlookers watch intently.
Big round of applause. Let them know they can't hear you.
The Department of Cultural Resources Underwater Archaeology Division had a goal of lifting 3 cannons. However, they were only able to lift 2. As the divers and underwater archaeology team celebrate their successful lift, Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab Director and Chief Conservator Sarah Watkins Kenny's work is just beginning. She says the cannons will be taken to the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab at East Carolina University in Greenville, where they'll remove the concretion and prepare them for exhibition.
These things have been in the ocean for 300 years. We want to do as little as possible to disturb that environment they've been in, because we can, if they dry out before we treat them, then that can get chemical and physical changes that could damage the object. So we want to prevent that happening. So we keep everything wet and then get it into tanks, then it's safe, and then we can take a deep breath, and then we figure out next what we do next with it, which will be eventually cleaning, eventually getting all the salts out, drying them, surface finishing them, and then finally they'll go to the museum for display.
So far, about 280,000 items, including the ship's bell, straight pins, gold flakes, lead shot, bottles, and guns have been recovered from the wreck. One of the 3,000-pound anchors, more than 11 feet long and 7 feet across, was brought up in 2011. It's currently soaking in a huge vat at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab, where it will stay for a few more years. The conservation of artifacts from the wreck site has been ongoing for 16 years. The Friends of the Queen Anne's Revenge is a private, not-for-profit group that supports the work of the state of North Carolina on the recovery of the wreck of Blackbeard's flagship. Richard Lawrence is president of the Friends of Queen Anne's Revenge and the former deputy state underwater archaeologist for the Department of Cultural Resources. He says the site and the artifacts are part of North Carolina history and need to be preserved.
If you were to ask a person to identify or name a pirate, the average person on the street, probably the first one to come to mind would be Blackbeard. And the fact that we have Blackbeard's flagship just a mile off our North Carolina coast, it's just an incredible opportunity for us.
If you want to learn more about Blackbeard and his ties to North Carolina, you can view artifacts from the Queen Anne's Revenge at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal today. Happy holidays, and see you next year.